Hello and welcome to the Daughters of Charity Services podcast, where we take you to the front line of UK charities and explore how to live out the 400-year Vincentian charism to meet the needs of marginalised and underprivileged people in our society today. I'm your host, Rihanna. Thank you for joining me. In this episode, I am joined by Ellie from the Louise Project, a charity launched by the Daughters of Charity and supports people experiencing extreme poverty in Govan Hill in Scotland. The charity operates a community drop-in centre called The Space, and today Ellie shares how The Space has helped to transform the lives of people in the Roma community.
How are you doing?
It's a very cold morning, but I'm doing okay. It's a Friday, so it's quite a good mood in here. How are you?
I'm good. Yes, the temperature's definitely dropped now.
I can already see it like being very dark and cloudy, and it's in the rain. You can hear it slamming on the roof.
Yeah, it's not nice at all.
No, I've still got my coat on because it's so cold.
We finally come to turning on the heating. We've been trying to hold off for as long as possible, but it's time.
Yeah, well, I think I'm going to go home and put the heating on too today. So it's the first time.
How has your week been?
It's been busy. There's a lot of complex issues as well that have just unraveled somehow. So it's been keeping us busy.
So let's do a bit of an introduction into exactly what it is that the Louise Project does and who you support and your role there, just to get a bit of an understanding for listeners.
So the space, and we run to enable people to transform their own lives. And we do this through, you know, helping people access appropriate services and participate in the social transformation of the community, which is Govan Hill, which is the most marginalised when it comes to the Roma community. We don't support just the Roma community. We support everybody who's experiencing poverty, but specifically persistent poverty, which the Roma community fall into that category. So we run on five streams of activity. So we do a drop-in, which is a community drop-in. Then we do community integration and building for better futures. We started this wonderful thing, which I'm so excited about. So every Wednesday afternoon, we would do a community shop. Now, the community shop ran only based on donations. So whatever we got donated, that's what we would use to stock up the shop. So from there's a parish nearby, you would donate soap powder for us and fabric softener. There was another church who donated shampoos and conditioners. So everything we had was from donations, and we stocked up the shop and made it look great. And Pamela and Rahela, our two translators, would run the shop. So they would be the sort of shop advisors, or, you know, behind the counter. And the woman would come in. It was good, but at the moment we don't have any donations, and there's hardly anything we can sell. I mean, we would sell shampoos for 50p, you know. It was just something for the woman to give, so that then we could stock up the shop again, and also gave the woman some dignity, you know, because all the women would come in groups and they would shop and chat during it. It was very social event. But anyway, we didn't get any big donations recently, so we didn't have enough to stock the shop and keep the shop running. So instead, I know it is. So we didn't run it for 2 weeks now, and the woman would still come and ask for the shop, you know, and we just felt, oh my goodness, we don't want to send them away. So what we're doing instead, and this was all Pamela's idea. So I'm so proud of her. She said, you know, well, why don't we just do one shop a month? So we'll do one shop a month at the end of every month, every last Wednesday. And every week we'll just have coffee and tea on the tables with biscuits and invite ladies just to sit and relax and chat. So we did that this week for the first time, and the women loved it. Everybody was sitting around. We just made a big massive table, and everybody was sitting around, and we chatted, and it was so much fun. So that still gave them that social,
yeah,
you know, space. And they were still able to buy soap powder because that's the only thing that we still have. But we couldn't just sell soap powder at the shop, you know. So the woman was still able to buy soap powder after the chat. But we've got some great ideas from the woman because a woman, I don't know if you know, but the Romanian sort of signature dish is sarmale.
Oh, what's that?
It's like cabbage rolls, but with like a meat and rice filling.
Oh, yum.
It's so good.
Sounds every great.
Time somebody's birthday in here, we ask Pamela to make us some sarmale instead of cake.
Oh, I might have to try that.
It's so good. And all the women were like, you know, I make the best sarmale. I make this best sarmale. So Michelle, our project worker, she was like, right, we need to decide who's best sarmale in Govan Hill. And the woman's like, yeah, let's do MasterChef.
This is amazing.
I know, it was so good. So we've now come to a decision that we'll run a competition on who's got the best sarmale. We've asked all the women to bring in 4 sarmale on a plate and we'll judge it on smell and presentation and taste.
Yeah.
And the winner will get a set of pots and pans.
That is such a wonderful idea.
I know. And it was all the women, you know, that kind of, if we did not have that chat in that afternoon, we wouldn't have this such a great idea. And we've listened to the women and we can give them what they asked for. So
yeah, absolutely. Why do you think the donations have dried up recently?
Probably because everything's just so expensive and people maybe don't have that much or they can't afford to give anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So it's even affecting now the people who aren't necessarily living in the dire situations of the women that you're helping, but the people who usually support them are actually now finding it difficult to give and donate.
Most of our donations do come from churches.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you know, some churches get other funding, but most are also based on offerings, you know, from people.
Yeah.
So it's getting tougher and tougher, I think.
Just so we can get a bit of an understanding of exactly the problems and issues that some of the families come to you with, let's go back to your history. Tell us what it was like when you went back to visit Slovakia when you were 16, which is where a lot of the people you support come from, and exactly what life is like there.
Mm. So when I was 3, that's when we've come to the UK to look for a better way of living, better life. I can't really remember most of it, obviously, because I was so young. But it was very difficult because we were, from what my parents would tell me, we were seeking asylum when we first arrived. And we have been granted asylum based on, because we were, you know, experiencing very severe racial tension back at home. We stayed here for 5 years. And then as soon as I was sort of a school age, just after I was supposed to start education, we went back to Slovakia because my parents decided, you know, it's probably best if you go back home for you to go to school. But I've only lasted for 3 years because straight after, my dad experienced the racism again. You know, I would be in class and the teacher wouldn't really pay any attention to me. I would be sometimes sitting at the back of the class as well, just for no reason at all. You know, the teacher would just send me back. Most of my family and friends, they were all put into special schools, which the Slovakian education system it surprises me every time. Because if you have some learning difficulties, then you are placed in a special school to help to, you know, so you're separate from the normal children, so that they can focus on the ones that really can make it, you know. It's really sad.
Wow.
I was not placed in a special school. I was still kept in normal school, thankfully, but a lot of my friends and neighbours and family were all placed in special schools. And it's terrible because what they've classed as a learning difficulty is if you cannot speak Slovak. So I am Roma, I speak Romanes, but I also speak Slovak. And the only reason I learned Slovak is because my mum would speak in Slovak to me. But a lot of the families would only speak Romanes. Mm-hmm. And the parents would speak Romanes to the child. And when they sent that child to school, that's when they expect for that child to then learn some of the mm-hmm. Slovak. Mm-hmm. But the schools would then class that as a learning difficulty because they wouldn't have the language. You know, and if they couldn't communicate in Slovak, then it just gives them another reason to send them to special schools. And some of these children are very capable, you know, mm-hmm. of learning very fast. I mean, when I first arrived, I had no English, but mm-hmm. I wasn't separated and put in a different education system and completely different path because I couldn't speak the language. You know, it's just realistic. So anyway, so then my father quickly came back and realized, you know, well, there's no future for my children here.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was no money, my dad couldn't find a job because he was Roma. So we came back. And since then, we've always just stayed. I've never been back or thought about going back to Slovakia.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was 16, I had to get my passport and my ID card, and I couldn't get it done here. So we went to Slovakia and we went to visit friends and family in a village. And it was most of my mother's cousins. And when I saw the village that I walked into, where I used to live when I was younger, and where my mum grew up, I broke down in tears because I could not believe it. It was just thinking back. It's quite difficult for me to talk about it, but it's like the slums, really. You know, there's water coming in people's houses, that there's no proper locks on doors. The doors don't even reach the floor. So that's all the water just comes in. There's no proper roofs. It was terrible.
And these are the situations that the Roma community are living in and are pushed into because of the racism in Slovakia.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're a Roma, you won't really find a job, you know, because they can tell by your surname that you're a Roma or your skin color. And, you know, if you go for an interview, I don't think, you know, they probably wouldn't even give you an interview if they've seen your surname on the CV. Most job adverts actually do say, you know, we do not want Roma in our company.
That's shocking.
I know. Yeah. You know, if you can't get a job, you can't really feed your family, you know.
Exactly. And then there's cultural poverty, there's financial poverty. I can imagine mental health, living in those sorts of situations are terrible. So there is no wonder that people want to escape that type of life and get away, which is why many of the Roma community are coming to you. They come over to the UK, and as you know, it's not as easy for them to integrate into society here as well. So let's talk about some of the issues that they face when they do come over here. What issues are they presenting when they turn up to the space?
So the first thing is language. Not just talking about English language, but also their mother tongue. Because Romanes is non-written, it's a nomad language. You wouldn't have proficiency in it. You know, you wouldn't be able to communicate only verbally. And that was very difficult for us then, because the women couldn't read and write, and not just English, but in their own languages. So we've helped by putting together a literacy class that provides nursery education for adults. And we teach women the alphabet from scratch. We teach them penmanship. We you know, we'll do all the primary school, you know, nursery, you know, going through the lines to make letters, and the women really enjoy it. If I was, you know, helping a lady filling out an application form and then she needs to sign it at the end and I would hand over the pen to her, you know, to sign it, you could tell her how uncomfortable she felt, and she was laughing. She's like, I can't sign, I don't, you know, and she would put a cross for the signature. And this lady's probably in her late 30s. So that's one of the things. So it'd be language. The other things would be the scarcity mindset, you know, this mindset that the Roma community have had, and that's always going to be with them. It's very difficult to put into work on changing somebody's mindset. It doesn't happen over time, you know. I would probably say maybe 5 generations down, that's when you can change the mindset of a family, especially when the community's so close, and everything they learn is from their parents, and their parents from their grandparents, you know. The other thing is that we figured out that there's not just financial poverty. There's all sorts of different cycles of poverty. And when it comes to the Roma community, they tick every single cycle, every single category in what makes a person poor.
Mm-hmm. And what are those categories?
I'll need to check, but it would be, you know, well, financial would be one. It would be educational poverty, education.
It's scary to think that this poverty is so ingrained and it's so intergenerational that it's very, very difficult to pull them out of it. It's not just a matter of helping them find a job and then they're okay. These people can't read and write.
Yeah. Because it's generational poverty, which is, you know, the families, all they've known is poverty. All they've known is racism. All they've known is struggle and crisis. And that's how they've survived for so many years, you know. It's trying to survive on a daily basis, you know. It's not even the community and the families that we work with as well. They can probably plan just for that day. There's no plans for the future or a week ahead. They don't see a week. They don't know what that week will bring to them. Mm-hmm. They only live day to day. And that's why some of them will have problems with budgeting. Some of them will, because they think, oh, well, I have money now. Doesn't mean I'll have money next week.
How do they get by day to day in terms of finances? If, you know, if they can't speak their language, they find it difficult to get jobs. How do they survive when they first come to you? What are their housing conditions like?
Well, most families, when they first come over, they go stay with somebody who's already here. So they will stay with friends, with family, with just somebody that they know from the same village where they live back in Romania or Slovakia. So they would stay with them, and it would be very overcrowded, you know, because the families have 3+ children, you know, that families are quite big families.
Yeah.
So we stay all together and especially here in Glasgow, in Governor Hill, there's no big flats. You know, the biggest flat you'll get is a 2-bedroom, and you'll have easily, you know, 3-4 families living in that 2-bedroom flat. But this is how they survive. They rely on their friends and family to help. They rely on somebody else being there for them from the community. You know, if they know there's somebody in Glasgow and Govan Hill that I know and I need, and I'm having a really hard time back home, and they can help me live a better life, they'll open that up and you know, invite that person into the house, even though they know that the only space that they have in the house is next to the fridge, you know.
And
they'll happily give that up.
Sleeping probably on a kitchen floor next to a fridge is a better situation than it is back at home. And that's scary when you think of it like that. That's their reality.
And then after that, you know, the only job that they can get is a very low-skilled job. So most of the time they would work in the car wash or, you know, factories. Not even, some factories do not, you know, they require like application forms and somebody to communicate in English. So not even factories.
No.
It would just be cash in hand, quick jobs. Yeah. you know, with like deliveries, when somebody gets a delivery, like a local convenience shop, they would help, you know, they'll just basically help empty out the van, and it's not permanent, you know, it's just whenever they get a delivery. So that's another job that the Roma men would do in Glasgow. Then that means that when they live with somebody, they do not have their own address. That's one of the things. So they come, they'll get here, great, they've got somewhere to sleep, but that means that they will not have any letter with their name on it, so will not have a tenancy agreement. They will not be allowed to use that address, because the family that live there will already be claiming benefits on the address on the household, so they wouldn't share the address with the family that lives with them. If they get a cash in hand job, they have, again, no letters. They have no job contract. You know, they've got nothing. So then, for example, now with Brexit and the EU settlement scheme applications, the family could be living here for 10 years like that.
Wow.
And when, you know, the EU settlement scheme now comes and they need to prove the residency for them to get the right to remain, they cannot prove that they've been here living. So that means they cannot get that right. And there's been cases of families where they have no letters. They've been here for 7 years. They've got no letters, nothing. They can't, yeah, can't get their rights to stay. Now, the other issue is even though, because it's so overcrowded in Govan Hill, there's no spaces in schools. Children are waiting years to get a placement. Obviously, the council is great, and you know, they offer them different schools to go to. However, because they come from a country full of racism that is, you know, not even, you know, under the it's in your face racism, you know, and if they come from a country like that, they will not trust anybody. So there's trust issues. There's, they will not trust their landlord, they will not trust the schools, they will not trust nobody.
It's trauma they've gone through, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's absolute trauma. And you can't just wipe that and start afresh. It's, that takes a lot of time to recover.
Yeah. So imagine you've got this, you know, feeling of, I can't trust anybody around me. And you get a letter from the council, you know, because you've got a school that's maybe 5 minute walk from you, but that school's full. And you get a letter from the council, right, this school's full, but we can offer you this one. And it's like a 20-minute bus ride. You will not send that child to that school if it's so far, because you cannot speak English. You've never been on a bus. You can't run to your child if there's a problem. The child cannot run back home if there's a problem. You know, when I first started school, when I first arrived, my mum told me, if somebody says anything to you, run home.
Wow. Wow.
That's the message that some parents send their children to school with, you know.
They are so scared.
Because they're so scared. And imagine that school so far that your child cannot find their way home. They're not going to send that child to that school, because they want that child to be able to run from anything that might happen in that school.
The fact that they have got that much fear in them that something is going to happen to their child at school, that they may need to escape like that, is terrifying. That is so sad.
Mm. And see, and this is one of the things that we do, you know, we help, we are being alongside of the families, and we help develop relationships based on truthfulness and trust and accountability. And we do it by, you know, being compassionate and gentle with them. And what that helps is also having somebody employed in the project that is Roma, because then you could trust their Roma, you know, somebody else from the same community. So they'll probably open up and be, you know, more open. So that's some of the issues, some of the things that are keeping people poor and keeping people in that same mindset. So,
and you can see why they do come to you just feeling so hopeless. They don't know what to do.
Sometimes when I speak to somebody else and I hear them, oh, they're all, you know, they're all beggars, they're all out on the streets. But if you cannot read and write, And you cannot, you can't communicate in a language that's recognized. You only speak a language that only your community can speak. Tell me what else you have.
When you've got children to feed, what do you do? And that's where I think the Vincentian values come into it, because it's supporting people with compassion and dignity and respect, regardless of how they're presenting. How do these families begin to pull their lives back together? How would they go about getting that first house that can actually, you know, is suitable for their family, instead of a family of five or six literally sleeping on the floor in one room for years on end? What does that look like for a family? How do they go about coming out of that type of poverty?
Some families do not even want to get help from anywhere else because they are afraid that social work will get involved, and because the way that the Roma community live and the way that they find comfortable, you know, maybe for us it wouldn't be comfortable, you know, living in such crowded conditions. But for these communities, for these families, that's normal. They've known this back home, they're fine, you know. So for them, it's, they feel quite comfortable, but it would be quite worried to open those doors to a social worker who might come in and be like, right, there's something, you know, wrong here. So some families will really, really, really try and keep out away from authority. But if there is a family, and there have been families that we've helped to find themselves housing, is showing them pathways where they can get social housing. So we had a family who left Romania and came here to join her husband, who was already here with two children. Mm-hmm. And that the father, well, the man, lived with a friend for a long time before he managed to save up for a deposit to get a private house. Now, this is great because clearly the father and the man had a really great planning, and he planned it all out, and he wants the better life for their family. But most of the families are not that capable of thinking the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them will just live in crowded environments like that for a long time until somebody says, right, that's enough, you need to leave, and they'll go back to Romania or Slovakia or whatever. But some families, if they have trust in us and they trust us with their applications, will be able to apply for a house. They can live in that crowded a house until they get rehoused. And some families, you know, can wait up to 3-6 months, and then that's great. But recently, what the situation has done now is people are sick of living like this, and they all present as homeless because they realize, you know, I cannot live with this person for such a long time. I don't have enough money to get my own place, especially a private let that is extortionate in the south side. So they go present themselves as homeless. But the issues are, because they have such big families, there's no house, temporary accommodation that they can give them that's close to where they stay now. It all be across the city, and families will not want, they're reluctant to leave the environment and the place, the location that is known to them.
Yeah.
So even there's help there that they can get, but because of how terrified they are being somewhere where they don't recognize it, they would rather stay in that situation.
Yeah.
And I know it's not the best way forward. It's not, you know, what's probably best for that family. But what we've done is recently about 21 families have presented as homeless, and we've helped them all to just take that location where they've been given and just stay there. And we'll try and help as much as we can. And all families are doing well, and they're all in their temporary accommodations. I mean, they phone us and tell us, right, I'm so far, I've not seen my friend from my thing, you know, and I need this and I can't get this, and I feel so lonely, I don't have anybody here. And you know, but it's temporary for them. Maybe temporary of 6 to 9 months is probably a long time, but it is temporary. And I'm just so happy for the families to gain so much trust in us that if we recommend and give them, you know, advice and give them the information and the consequences from each decision that they can make, then we can trust that they make that right decision. and look back and think, oh my goodness, you know, it was me. I've come so far, and look at me now. I'm living alone, and I can go to the shop myself. You know, it's great
to be able to help a family like that. So how do you communicate with them? You have translators, right?
Yes, so we have two translators who are Romanian Roma translators. We've got two project workers, and we've got a lot of volunteers that come in and help out. But the Romanian Roma translators are great. I think they're the best in government.
Yeah.
And we're so lucky to have them. So.
And going back to the whole proof of address issues, obviously that's really difficult when it comes to applying for things like right to remain. What other issues does that cause? Because I'm sure people won't be able to, they won't be able to sign up to things like doctor's appointments for their children and all of those sorts of things. So,
Well, that's interesting that you bring it up, because we have had so many families that want to register to a doctor. And the doctors would not register these families because they would ask for proof of address. Mm-hmm. Now, we thought, right, let's look into this. Is there a way we can pass this? So we found out that a proof of address is not a requirement for GPs to request this. And it should not delay seeking medical attention or getting an appointment or getting help. So we have printed out this official document and gave it to every single family that would not get help with registration. So they're refusing GPs to register them, and they all got registered. That's without fantastic. Proof of address.
Yeah.
And that just shows you that there's one more thing that's keeping these people poor.
Yeah.
Without help, without that dignity, because they would not be able to figure this out themselves.
And that then increases health poverty. You know, it's just an ongoing spiral of unfortunate events that are just contributing to their lack of being able to survive in society.
And you're absolutely right. You know, these families survive. They're not living. Mm-hmm. And this is what's so sad. And if I think about all their children, and they cannot really get that good education and that chance to educate themselves, they'll probably be like their parents in this advanced technological era that we're in, you know, and they will miss out. They will not be integrated into society for another generation. And this is it, you know. But, you know, we enable people to be social. We give them a place to belong. We help them integrate into a community. We help them develop some sort of self-esteem to be able to believe in themselves, that they can learn something new. Obviously, we help them meet their physical needs. Say, you know, we refer them to Food Bank and other places. We provide literacy classes. We help them access welfare benefits. And that's what helps them come back to us and look at the next steps we can take together. Because 10 years ago, they were all so much worse than they are now. They were all destitute. And now, because we've helped so many families access welfare benefits, now they've got the finances, but they cannot make decisions that will help their future, because they are still in that survival mode. But I'm very thankful for this project, because I feel like I've got a calling to be here, you know, and that I can share my journey to integration, really, and how I've managed to, you know, even I've started in primary four, I started education, and I've managed to go through it, through secondary school, through college, through university, and I could share that, and I hope and I wish and I pray that every single child whose parents come here to look for a better future, that child does get it.
Absolutely. And it's amazing what you do. How many families are you supporting at the moment?
So all together, I would say close to 400 families.
Oh, goodness. Wow. Wow. And those families, as you said, have up to, you know, 3+ children.
Yeah.
That is an incredible amount.
Mm.
You have, I mean, you don't have a massive staff team. You have wonderful volunteers as well that help. Mm-hmm. But how many people are working at the project?
So we have 7 volunteers. We've got 2 project workers, 2 translators, and we've got a digital inclusion coordinator. And that's that. That's our whole team. Myself and Margot, the CEO of the project, but that's really it. I mean, I say 400 families, but these are old families, but these are families that first came to the project, and we still are in contact with. Some of them have returned to Romania, but we're just waiting anytime they'll come back.
Yeah.
And we've got completely new families and families that have been with us, so collectively all of them together. But you know, it's great, because when the project first opened, it was just opened for anybody. You know, they were there, they were just being a sense of presence, and it was the Roma community that found the project, and they were then able to come through the door and share their needs and share their stories. And then the project went through 13 months where they've gathered data, and they were able to make and design the space so that the space can be, as you know, that next location with everything that the Roma community has shared and the evidence that they've gathered and data they've gathered, and design it in such way to be able to be helpful and not to be a waste.
Yeah.
And every part of our building, every part of our strategy is being used to its full potential. So it's a great form, and it's just a great plan, and we can really see the pathway that the families have taken, and really see that development to better themselves and give their children a better future.
Yeah. One thing I love about the Louise Project is what percentage is it of your staff are from the Roma community, and some are from the people that you have supported?
It's about 40%, really, because I'm Roma and the 2 translators are Roma.
Yeah.
And one of the project workers is married to a Roma.
Wow.
So we really know the culture, we know the community, we live in the community, we are the community, and it works fantastically well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like a family. It's somewhere safe that they can come to.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a drop-in twice a week where the families come in and we focus on crisis support. We've got community integration where we then help with accessing services, so like housing and banking and social activities. You know, so we have different activities that we can that we put together, you know, so a building community as well, where we bring across different ethnic backgrounds and bring them together. I mean, our literacy classes are not just the Roma ladies. We've got Muslim ladies, we've got a lady from Portugal, we've got Czech ladies, Slovak ladies. So it's a great way to build social trust within the community. So
absolutely, yeah. I can imagine even grocery shopping would be difficult when you don't have the means for a phone, for banking, for to be able to read what you're buying, those types of things. The digital poverty is massive, and it's just only increasing because everything is digitalized now.
Well, absolutely. Even, you know, I'm monitoring their welfare benefits, like universal credit. It's all on the floor, on the phone. You know, it's a system. It's a digital system, and you need to have a smartphone to be able to access it. You know, and smartphones are expensive. And if you cannot read and write, I doubt that if you give somebody a phone, that they'll know what to do with it.
No, absolutely. I mean, they're hard enough for somebody who can read and write. It's confusing.
We have a really good relationship with the food bank, and there was a issue where the ladies didn't want canned food, you know, and it was all, oh, they don't want cans, they only want you know, fresh things. And we've tried to, you know, figure out what was happening. And then we asked some of the ladies, you know, why do you not want the cans? And they're like, we don't know what's inside them.
Oh, of course.
So if there's no picture on it of what is inside, they don't know what's inside.
Goodness.
See if you know, have like the sort of as the own brand or any, you know, they don't actually have pictures of what it just says what it is. So if they cannot read, or if the picture does not, you know, because sometimes you'll have all mixed of vegetables, so they don't actually know what's inside, so they do not take it.
Of course, of course. And oh gosh, it's just everyday things that you and I now would not think about.
So if you think about all the things you would learn just by being in school, you know, you can you get taught how to tell time, like time management, friendship, relationship building. This is all you learn in education. If you don't have that education, you miss out, and you live like that without having those skills. So there's times that women will not know how to tell the time, or they'll struggle with time management. The project has employed Roma ladies before, and we had to send out somebody to go and wake them up to tell them it's time to come to work.
Okay.
Because they cannot plan, they cannot sort of calculate how long it'll take them to do this and how long it will take them to walk somewhere. It's things like that that you'd never ever think.
No. So obviously the UK and the world is going through a big economic crisis of the cost of living, and lots of people are finding themselves struggling more than they normally would be. But for these people who are already in such difficult situations, in such deep poverty, is this affecting them at all?
They don't even know that there's something happening in the world. They have no idea about any wars, any political views, anything. They have no idea. The cost of living is not affecting them at all, because they've always had crisis. They were always in crisis. They were always in poverty. You know, it's different being in situational poverty, because, you know, you lose your job, but then you find a job, and then that's you back on track. You're doing great. You know, you had that time where you were struggling, but you know that there's a chance for you in the future as soon as you find a job. But for this community, there's no future. There's no, when am I going to get well?
Yeah, that's so hard hitting. That's so sad. You're giving them that hope though, and that's the beautiful thing about the project.
Absolutely, Rihanna. Yeah, it's great to see families that really try, and they'll do anything for their children. You know, as a family, I've helped, and I was fighting an appeal for their welfare benefits, and they, you know, they turned out they were eligible. They were not eligible, but then I found a document and it proved that something, I can't really remember what it was, but I was fighting an appeal, and then they got the welfare benefits, they got their benefits, and it was a lump sum that they received, and the family were jumping in the air, and it was oh my goodness. And the next day, the family went shopping, and they went to Primark, and they from the shops, they came to the project to show me what they've got.
Oh, and what did they buy?
Oh, but it was jackets, and the boys had new trainers on, and the mother got a jacket as well. So it was a winter time back then.
Yeah.
As well.
So
it
basic
was all
necessity.
Things that they would need. It was great to see
those kind of little success stories that some people wouldn't think about. To be able to go to a shop and buy something that you need, like a jacket for the winter, is for them, that is such a luxury and such a win, and a win for the project.
The way we work here is very different. You know, we're very gentle, and we listen, and we go that extra mile to figure out how we can help this family. What, you know, and we don't just tell them what to do, you know, this is what you do, this is what you do. We give them the information in their own language so that they can understand. We give them a space where they can ask questions, and then they can then make that choice of what they want to do. And we don't just give them the options, we give them the information with the consequences of each decision that they will make. And then that allows them to make that decision. If they go with the wrong one, we then, you know, kind of say to them, well, you know, this is the consequence of this. Are you sure? Yes. So we just leave it, you know, well, if that's what you think, well, this is what's going to happen. If you don't understand this, then we'll still go ahead with this decision. Because it's their choice. We're giving them that choice. That what makes them human.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what gives them that dignity, that they can make their own choices.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a story, there's this older gentleman, and we love this gentleman because he's in here every day, and every letter he receives, he wants us to read it so that he can understand. And it's letters, you know, like mostly it's medical letters from the NHS, but there was one issue where he was having problems with his gas, and every time we arrange for somebody to come to look at the gas, they would phone ahead of coming, but he would never pick up. And this was going on for ages. You know, every time he'd come, nobody came in. So we would phone back and somebody would come back out again. And he wasn't answering the phone. I'm talking, this would go on for months, by the way. And we thought, right, what's happening here? So we said, show me your phone. It was a very old phone, and I tried ringing the phone, and all it was doing was going beep, beep. So the poor man didn't hear, and he had so many missed calls on his phone. So every time somebody was trying to reach him, he did not hear. And so I changed the ringtone for him to vibrate and something that's much louder. And then he managed to get somebody to see the gas. But oh my goodness. And it's things like that you would not even think about. And I doubt anybody else would say, you know, show me your phone.
Yeah. And so why was he seeing the missed calls coming up on his phone, or he just wasn't looking at it?
No, he wasn't looking at it. And it's things like that. You know, we don't just leave things. We really try and we'll do it.
Yeah.
Until that person gets help. But a lot of the work we do is advocacy work. Mm-hmm. There was a lady who was in overdraft, and on the statements, it would show her that she was in minus. But she did not understand what the minus means. So she thought that's how much money she's got on her account.
Oh, goodness.
So she kept using it. But you know, the other thing is, whenever she used it, that amount would go up.
She didn't realize
that that's what, you know, she couldn't calculate the amount. So she just thought, oh, maybe some money. I received some money or some benefits that came through. So she did not understand that the minus means that she's in minus.
And so the more she spent, the more she thought she had.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
And you know, this is not, we didn't even know this, because the first thing, she came in with a letter to say that the bank wants to close her account. And we didn't know why, obviously. We thought, oh my goodness, what's, you know, why? And it did show, you know, like a bank statement there. And she was like, I don't know why they want to sell it. So when we looked at the bank statements properly, we realized, right, you went into minus. And we tried to explain it to her. And she's like, I don't know. She's like, I have money on my bank, as you kept pointing to the amount. But we were like, no, that's in minus. So we tried to explain, you know, there's a zero and then you go under and then up. She did not understand. And we tried the translator, and she did not understand the way that worked.
Wow.
So we've asked her if she could go to the bank with somebody, because this was, you know, where COVID was still active. We really didn't want to visit anybody to their house and things like that. So we've asked if she's got somebody who speaks some English to go to the bank with her. No. So we wrote a letter and we asked her to take it to the bank. And she went to the bank, and the bank didn't even reply, because in the letter it said, you know, please can you reply in English behind the letter and she can bring it back to us. Nothing. Whenever we phoned to the bank, they asked security questions, which the lady didn't have, you know.
No.
She doesn't even know who opened the bank account for her.
No.
So there was no way. So I just decided, right, I'm just going to go to the bank with this lady. And when I went, the first thing I said, this lady did not understand that she was in minus. She cannot read and write. I'm from a charity, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I said, is there a way this can be? And they said, no, that the account is now closed. So I said, well, what can she do? And they opened another account for her, which I thought, wow. You know, I didn't think they could open another account. So when they did, if you believe it or not, they opened the same one that will allow her to go into overdraft. And I just lost it. And I said, right, she went into the overdraft because she did not understand, you know, could you remove the overdraft? And he was trying to like sell it to me, you know, oh no, it's great for her, she'll be able to. And I was like, please just listen to me. We're trying to keep this woman out of debt.
Yeah.
Please just give her a bank account that she could just pay, get cash out, and that's it.
Yeah.
And then after a while, he listened to me and he gave her the card. Can you imagine if he gave her another card, we would be in the same problem? Because the community don't even buy things with a card. I mean, now because there's contactless, more people use it, but most of the time they just like cash because they can,
count.
Because if it's just numbers on a sheet,
yeah,
they don't know what that number is.
No,
if they've got physical money, they are able to count it.
Yeah, that makes sense. In Romania and Slovakia, what's the education like?
If that woman went to school back in Romania, she would know, because you would learn things like this in school. But because she didn't go to school from the age of 11, maybe,
right,
she wouldn't know.
No.
And the culture and the community have created this way of living to survive. So that is why most ladies like to get married off quite young, so that she can then have children and get her own benefits and then survive. Because it's better to survive from an income if it's not a big family. So they understand this, and then the young lady can then go and live with her husband, with his mum, with like a mother-in-law, and that way it's better way of surviving. Because they know, why should I go get education? This is what their thinking is. And I know people that think like this, they would say, you know, why do I need school? I'm not going to get a good job anyway. Even I feel like this sometimes, even after now I've got this good job and I've got, you know, an education that's, you know, a degree level education, I still sometimes feel, you know, quite anxious about being Roma, and, you know, sort of think about what people think of me. You know, they probably look at me and go, oh, you know, well, look at this Roma girl who thinks that she's, you know, she's come so far. And I do feel anxious sometimes.
That's really sad. You absolutely deserve everything that you've worked for. Oh. And everyone deserves that choice. And everyone deserves to live well.
I mean, it is a human right.
It is, absolutely. Absolutely. You worked really hard to be there. Ellie, thank you so much for today.
I thank you, Rihanna. I thank you. It's great. And I really warms my heart for knowing people that are, you know, interested in caring for such a community that, you know, looks very lost. So thank you, Rihanna.
Thank you for sharing that, Ellie.
You've been listening to the Daughters of Charity Services podcast. To get all the latest news from our charities, check out the links and resources in the show notes, including how to sign up to our newsletter. I'm Rihanna. I hope to catch you at our next episode. Bye-bye for now.